Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Well, hello. I hope you're having a good day, and I think we have a really special show for you today. My story here begins about 8 years ago. I was doing one of my regular teaching workshops at Esalen, and a young man showed up at the workshop and said that he had been wanting to meet me for a long time. The young man's name was Brad Willis, and he proceeded to tell me a most amazing story. It's a story about personal courage. It's a story about love. It's a story about the remarkable ability that our bodies have to heal, particularly when we can focus our minds in the right way. I think you're going to love meeting him. Welcome to Conversations with Extraordinary People, Brad.
Thank you very much.
Can you recall back when we first met and the story that you told me?
Well, I surely can, almost as if it's yesterday, even though it's hard to believe that it's been 8 years since that time I showed up at Esalen on the coast of California below Big Sur to find someone whose voice had started the journey of changing my life. I had had a broken back and a failed back surgery and been a cripple, declared permanently disabled, living in a large body brace called a clamshell that felt like a clamshell, the metal rod going down one leg, and pickled on every pharmaceutical medication you can possibly imagine. Yeah. And I spent 7 years that way and unable to even sit up for a meal. And during that time, as I'm sure we'll talk about, that I was towards the end of that time diagnosed with terminal cancer from exposure to depleted uranium used in the Persian Gulf War by American troops to pierce Iraqi tanks. And I was told that it was stage four and terminal and I would die. And really on the brink of death, I had an epiphany. And I detoxed off of all medications and was sort of stranded at the hospital after I had gone through the darkest night of the soul. And they vectored me into a very experimental program, blending ancient Eastern healing modalities with Western holistic techniques. And one of the very first things I did was sit down in a biofeedback room. And I had never even heard the term biofeedback. And they hooked me up to take my temperature and galvanic skin response and brain waves to all these computers and then put headphones on me and begin to play a tape as I closed my eyes. And it was your voice in a guided visualization, and it just took me to another world.
And what did you experience in that world?
Well, you know, before that, I had had so many years in terrible pain and anger and anxiety and stress. And I had been a foreign war correspondent for NBC News, so I was pretty jaded and cynical along with everything else that had happened. And I really didn't believe in much of anything at this point in my life. And your voice took me to such a place of serenity and relaxation, really something I don't feel I had ever experienced in my life before. And the technician came in and showed me all the computer screens. It showed that my busy mind had gone down to a calmer mind, that my heart rate had lowered, that my respiration was smoother and more even. And I think I came to realize that that was the first time in my adult life that I had really relaxed, and that that relaxation was a pathway to my healing.
Mm-hmm. And that was down at Scripps?
I was at Scripps Hospital. I live in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
I had come back from, broken back from Hong Kong, where I had been posted in all of Asia for the network. And I had lived here as a permanently disabled person. And I checked into a Scripps La Jolla Hospital to go through the detox program. This all happened because, despite my difficult circumstance and a crumbling marriage, I had a little boy. And I was diagnosed with cancer shortly after his birth. That was in just before Christmas of 1997. 6 months later, they told me I would die before the year 2000. I had stage 4 cancer throughout my lymphatic system and big tumor on my neck. And as I was ending that period of really dying, and my weight had plummeted, big black circles under my eyes, again pickled on morphine, Vicodin, Valium, Prozac, and easily a bottle of wine every night. And my little boy was my only touchstone. I had just walked away from everything besides him, and he was the only tender place in a heart that had become very, very dark.
You know, Brad,
and he looked at me one day and just said, "Get up, Daddy. Please get up, Daddy." And that did something to me. It sort of cracked me open.
Uh-huh.
And that's what caused me to go into this detox unit at Scripps Hospital in La Jolla, thinking, well, I'll die with dignity. I just want to show this boy that his father tried to get up Daddy and at least got off all of these drugs that had so pickled my mind and shrouded my soul, that at least I could do that for him and then leave him with a memory of a father who at least made some sort of last valiant stand.
Wow. I think you're describing it as being pickled is a beautiful descriptive word for what was going on. And, you know, and actually, I just want to mention that to our listeners that you'll be having a book released next spring that's entitled Living Proof, which I've read, and then you've allowed me to even contribute to the foreword of the book. And, you know, I think people are going to love the book, and I think it will make a fantastic movie. So I want to be the first to go on the record saying if any of you folks out there are interested in an incredible adventure movie, this is a Indiana Jones kind of movie. In fact, let's back up a little bit, because, you know, I see a lot of people who come to see me because they have teenagers or children or young people who are just sort of lost and wandering around and just don't know where to go, and they're very frightened about it, and it just looks like they just can't imagine that anything positive can happen. But you were kind of a lost youth in a sense, weren't you?
Well, you know, I came of age in the 1960s, and I was born in Los Angeles, and all I remember as a child was suburb after suburb being built around me, and I felt, you know, really thoroughly disenfranchised and out of place. At the same time, we had the Civil Rights Movement, which I felt very, very strongly about, and the Vietnam War was on, which I greatly opposed. And so I felt a tremendous amount of anger and rage and dissociation inside of me. And I joined civil rights marches, and I joined war protests, and I tried to make a difference in that way. But I also just sort of wanted to drop out of everything. And as soon as I was old enough, I got in my van and I took off, and I went up into the woods of Northern California in Humboldt County, and decided I just would have nothing to do with the world, and I would just live in the woods in a little cabin, and that would be my life. I just didn't want any part of a career. I didn't want any part of a country that was waging what what I felt was an unjust war. I didn't want any part of society that discriminated against people based upon their race or their gender or their sexual preference. I just wanted out.
Mm-hmm. And you headed north.
I headed north and just put it all behind me. Huh. And again, didn't want anything to do with the system. But I think the danger was, and I think this is true for a lot of people who might feel this way, is where does one turn?
Mm.
Obviously, one place that we can turn is drugs, and that's usually an unproductive avenue to pursue and will only cause us more suffering and a whole host of legal and social and mental, physical problems. Fortunately, after a while in the woods, as I matured a little bit, I decided that I wanted an education, and I matriculated at Humboldt State, up the state college there, and finished a degree and went to graduate school and sort of fancied myself being a professor and wearing tweed coats and smoking pipes and quoting poetry. English was my major. But as I was finishing graduate school, I realized that's not me. I'm not meant to be a professor. This doesn't describe who I am. I still have all these feelings about wanting to make a change in the world, if I'm going to be in it at all. And by happenstance, I was driving by a little television station in Eureka, California, called KBIQ. And I always noticed it because it had one of the first clocks in town that told us the time and told us the temperature outside. And for some reason, I parked in their parking lot and I walked in my flannel shirt and blue jeans and work boots. And the first person I met was the general manager of the station, an incredibly jovial guy. And he said, "You must be the young man here looking for the reporter's job." And I said, "You're absolutely right. That's me." And he took me back to the newsroom, and they did a whole audition, and there was one job open, and a lot of journalism graduates were applying for it. And fortunately, I knew how to write because I had graduated in literature, and I had played around with 16-millimeter film cameras in the art department at the university as part of my minor, so I knew how to work their film equipment at the time. This was before digital film. And I was relaxed because I thought it was all a lark, and at any moment the real person who had that job interview would arrive in a suit and tie and they'd throw the imposter out, and that would be it. To make a long story short, they hired me. And I was off and running, and suddenly I had found what I'd always been looking for. I was able to then, as a reporter, orient myself towards what we call investigative reporting and reveal injustice in the world and to try to make a difference. Found the redwood companies up there illegally cutting in Redwood National Forest, exposed corruption in the police force and in the city council and so forth, and became a champion for people who were defrauded by the business community. And it launched a career and it gave me an identity. And I loved it so much that it's all I did. Ultimately, through that process, I worked my way up through larger and larger television markets in larger cities, Sacramento and Dallas and Boston, and ultimately was hired by NBC News as a foreign correspondent.
And there began a whole set of adventures, huh?
Yes, even before that, I went into Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation and was with the freedom fighters called the Mujahideen up in the mountains. This is when Osama bin Laden was a good guy to America, and working with the CIA. Was inside Africa during apartheid, the discrimination in South Africa against the indigenous black people. And then with the network, I was off and running in Central America and South America when the Gulf War broke out, and I was dispatched over there and became one of the frontline correspondents for all the networks in the pool system that they had covering the Persian Gulf War.
Uh-huh. Well, it's one of the stories that I liked from your book has to do with your little adventure in Afghanistan. Would you tell us that story? I think our folks would like to hear that.
Surely. And, you know, I'd just like to say that I have a wonderful publisher for the book, and they've changed the title to Warrior Pose because, as I imagine we'll discuss, ultimately, yoga was a central piece of healing myself and saving my life. And it's a particular pose where you stand, and it's called Warrior Pose.
Yeah.
Having been a war correspondent, it was a nice twist of the phrase.
Yeah.
The book is Warrior Pose.
Okay.
About my own healing journey. In Afghanistan, we several little things happened, but first it was very difficult to get in. We had to go in through Peshawar, Pakistan, and through the tribal territories, where everybody's armed with a Kalashnikov machine gun, and there is no law, and warlords hold sway. And then secretly enter Afghanistan, where the Soviets at the time had claimed that they would execute any foreign journalists they found coming into the country. And so we had made it through these territories, and we were winding up into the mountains late at night in the pitch dark with no headlights on, and suddenly we're surrounded by men in some sort of nondescript uniforms, all very heavily armed with automatic weapons. And of course, we can't let them know that we're Americans. We're with two armed mujahideen and with a guide who probably was a top part of the Afghan government, their own CIA, before the Soviets rolled in, and now he was working with us. We're trying to smooth everything over, and it's not looking good. And then they find our camera equipment, because we told them that we were doctors going to, you know, help set up some little trauma camps with
Oops.
The mujahideen, who were regularly terribly wounded, as were millions of people in the rural villages there. So just as they were about to accept the doctor's story, they found the camera equipment, and things got worse. And they were demanding, of course, in language I didn't speak, this Pashtun, that we have some sort of proof of who we are. And I pulled out our manifest, which is what we had to have documented to ship all of our camera equipment into Pakistan through the Pakistan embassy, and it had all sorts of official looking stamps all over it. And our two cameras were a Sony camera and a Betacam. And so I told Rasul, our CIA type guide, to tell them that I'm Dr. Sony and that my cameraman is Dr. Betacam, and point at the document and make a big thing of it. And he did, and lo and behold, to all our astonishment, it worked, and we were on our way again up into the mountains, ultimately connecting with the Mujahideen freedom fighters.
Ah. And what was the condition you found them in?
Well, it was quite amazing. We were from the valley floor suddenly in 10 to 12 feet of snow in the mountains, and these rugged men living in little huts there, hidden underneath the trees. And every morning, or periodically, they would go down before sunrise, hours down the mountain, and then attack Soviet outposts, because the Soviets only held the major cities and a few of the major highways, and then they would take their casualties and head back up the mountains. And we were filming that process. Very rugged and incredibly devoted people. I think even those freedom fighters who were 80 years old, it seemed, could out-hike me on any given day, and I was in great physical shape. I found them to be a tremendously devoted people who were able, because I think of the conviction that they had in their minds and in their hearts and in their souls, to endure conditions that I think most of us who live in the first world would find unimaginable.
And what did you discover when you were there for your story?
Well, after documenting the Mujahideen up in the mountains, we went down to the refugee camps where, as I said, there were some 5 million people. Some of the most horrifying conditions I've ever seen in my professional life. And little children with napalm burns all over their bodies, shrapnel in their faces, arms and limbs missing. And we filmed that too. Ultimately, we were able, when we broadcast our reports back in America, to airlift many, many of those children to hospitals who donated their services and their doctors and made them prosthetic devices, gave them facial and eye surgeries and things such as that. So again, as someone who had felt a need to make a difference in the world, that was, for me, through my career, an affirmation that I actually could. I didn't have to drop out of the world, that I could take action and actually see a change.
Uh-huh. And then, was it after that that you went to Africa?
Shortly after that, I went to Africa, but this gets to be a little bit of a difficult timeline to follow. I just want to mention that I took a rare vacation after Afghanistan.
Uh-huh.
I came home and we were granted a great award that I didn't even know about. It was the broadcast equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize,
mm-hmm.
called the Columbia DuPont Award. And I felt honored, and I also felt uncomfortable because it was difficult to go to a dinner in New York City with a tuxedo on to be awarded over a marvelous dinner, having documented the tremendous suffering of these people. Nevertheless, I took a vacation after that, and I was down in the Bahamas on a little island called Hope Island. No automobiles, very tranquil, trying to relax myself, which was something I was never very good at. And on the last night there, a tropical storm came up. I was battening down storm windows, thinking in the little cabin I had on the ocean there in a wooded area that the windows would shatter from the strength of the storm. And I got them all closed except one final one high up on a ledge, and I crawled up and twisted the handles real hard. They were corroded and they broke, and I fell about 12 to 15 feet onto the base of my spine.
Mm.
And it knocked me so hard that I honestly thought I might die not being able to take an inhale. I couldn't get a breath. I was gasping. Obviously, finally, the inhale came. I rolled into bed. I woke up the next morning, storm over, and I stood up to get out of bed and kind of fell down on my knees to the floor with the most horrible pain in my back that I'd ever felt in my life. And that began my descent into darkness.
Mm-hmm.
I toughed it out. I was young. I was type A. Nothing was going to stop me from this career that was unfolding in front of me. I hadn't even made it to the network at this time. I was with the Boston affiliate, WBZ-TV, when I went to Afghanistan. And I went back. They subsequently did send me down to Southern Africa to cover the struggle against the apartheid regime and ultimately the release of Nelson Mandela. And I just chewed anti-inflammatories, ibuprofen, and I drink a few more glasses of wine at night, and pushed on with my life and continued to push on as I was assigned down to South America to cover the drug summit with the first President Bush and the leaders of Colombia, Bolivia, and Peru in Cartagena, Colombia. After that, going up into the drug labs and the coca fields and doing my reportage there. And that got the attention of the network, and ultimately I was hired by NBC News, stationed to Miami Bureau, covering all of Latin America. Worked there for a while, down in Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, and so forth. And then the Gulf War broke out, end of 1989, I guess, and I was dispatched immediately over to Dahran, Saudi Arabia, which was the headquarters for all the international media covering the war, chosen to be one of the few pool correspondents stationed with the 1st Marines. Now, all this time, Dr. Miller, I'm mm-hmm. chewing anti-inflammatories, and after a while, I'm starting to take some Valium to calm my muscles, which are very tense, and it's just this ego and this alpha male energy that's making me push forward. I mean, nothing is going to stop me. And every time I saw a wounded child, a wounded innocent person, the horrors of war, I thought, my back means nothing. Look what's out here in the world. Push on, push on, push on. And that continued all through the war. I was in most of the major battles, and then up in northern Iraq as the Kurds sought their independence and were forced by the Iraqi army into refugee camps. So I'm flying into the mountains and going through the valleys and doing all this work. I really think I was so filled with adrenaline that it numbed my pain a little bit. It was a combination of adrenaline and unmitigated ambition. Ultimately, after that, I was given what to me was the plum of network news, which was to be in charge of all of Asia, the only region in my life I really had never seen. And I was moved to Hong Kong and covering all of China and Japan and Philippines and Thailand and Vietnam. Is quite fascinating for a very middle-class boy from a very middle-class college who once thought he wanted to drop out of the whole world and not participate, to suddenly be on the top of Victoria Peak in Hong Kong looking over this city that's like New York on steroids, and traveling the world and reporting for NBC Nightly News. It was remarkably heady and humbling at the same time. And I was there for about a year, and then I went to the Philippines to cover the return of Imelda Marcos. She and her husband Ferdinand had been thrown out of the country after stealing billions of dollars, and she came back to run for president. I went to Manila to cover that, and I was sitting in the historic Manila hotel reviewing videotape. And as it turned out, that injury, falling in that tropical storm to my lower back, had actually hairline fractured a pedicle. That's part of the little flange on the lowest vertebrae of my spine, called L5, the lumbar vertebra. And I suppose we could liken it to a small crack in a windshield of a car that one day just splits all the way open. And that it just split as I was sitting there. And I blacked out and fell on the floor, still conscious, but my vision blacked, and I'm screaming in pain that's shooting down both my legs and up my back and down my arms. And to cut to the chase, I was medevaced out. Medevaced ultimately back to San Diego, where I had a home base, and given a fusion laminectomy surgery where they go in and slice bones off the iliac crest of your hip, and they layer them into this area of your back where they slice the pedicle bone off, kind of like welding me together. Put me in a big body brace and told me I would be back to work in 3 to 6 months. And it never happened. The operation never took. The fusion failed. I was declared permanently disabled. My career was over. My identity was gone. I couldn't sit up for a meal. And now they had me on everything. Prozac, Vicodin, Valium, more ibuprofen, so muscle relaxers, antidepressants, narcotic painkillers. And my life began to tumble down into the darkest abyss. I spent from 1993 to 1998 this way. That's when my little boy said, "Get up, Daddy." And after I was diagnosed with cancer shortly after his birth, and I checked into that pain clinic in the year 2000, thinking I would die with dignity, detoxed, which was really a dark night of the soul, an incredible process to cold turkey after what turned out to be, you know, more than a decade of heavy, heavy medications, and ended up in that experimental clinic where I first heard your voice in biofeedback, and I realized that maybe I had some control over my destiny that I never knew that I had, that actually through the power of my mind, I could change what was happening inside my body, my heart rate, my brain waves, and that maybe there was a way to move forward.
Right now, you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People. This is Dr. Emmett Miller. I'm interviewing Brad Willis, the author of the upcoming book, A Warrior Pose. And so this is quite a, this is a turning point for you. You became aware that there was another way to do things. And what'd you do next?
This was a turning point, and again, I have to say, a turning point for a formerly very cynical journalist who would have thought that anything out of the mainstream was kooky. But here I was, you know, dying in chronic pain, and that opened me to a willingness to see things in a different way that I never would have been willing to do before. About a month into it, they started me on therapeutic yoga, and for reasons I can't say, I know the minute that I walked into that room, something deep, deep inside me that I had never accessed before said, this is it. This whole time, I'm continuing to do my get up, daddy mantra, along with something from your guided visualization. I am strong and healthy, calm and relaxed, again and again and again. And I started this very therapeutic yoga because I was as stiff could be and terribly pained. And I took to it like the fanatic I've always been in my life. I went back to the hotel next to the hospital where I was staying and had the concierge order me as many books as she could find on yoga. I devoured all of them, trying to go to the deeper practices right away. And about a month into that, the clinic was closed. The insurance companies would not reimburse them for these alternative treatments. I went home to my home in Coronado, a little island in San Diego Bay, took an office in my house and turned it into my healing room, which I called my Himalayan cave, after the caves in the Himalayas of northern India where all the ancient yogi sages used to go for their meditations. And I was in there 8 to 12 hours a day, only emerging when I had to feed my little boy or take him to preschool or pick him up or make him dinner, and then I'm back in my cave. And I did this for 2 years, really exploring the complete science of yoga, including Ayurvedic medicine, the healing system of yoga, and went through great and profound changes that way. Not just doing yoga postures, but I changed my whole life in body, mind, and soul. Of course, no medications and none of the alcohol that I used to consume so regularly. Completely changed my diet to pure vegetarianism. Began fasting for very long periods of time because I had gone up to from 180 to 225 pounds in my body brace. Because I continued to eat like a foreign correspondent during those years that I was pickled on medications and drink like two foreign correspondents, and yet I wasn't mobile. I was just lying around. Mm-hmm. I ended up taking 80 pounds off my body, calling it my organic chemotherapy. And first I learned to relax. First I learned to let go. And then I learned to become more flexible in my body and in my mind. And then I began to strengthen and empower myself through stronger yoga poses, through stronger self-affirmations and visualizations and pranayama, deep breath work. And lo and behold, in 1 year, I was out of back pain. I had vanquished it. It was gone. And my body was so flexible that I could put both legs behind my head. Could do handstands and headstands. This is from someone who had been crippled for years and years and had never been flexible before. And then I started working more on the cancer, more fasting, pure veganism, and ultimately there came a day when I knew that the cancer was gone. Again, the war correspondent would have scoffed at such talk, but I knew, and it turned out to be the truth. And I emerged from that cave and began to live my life again, now as someone named Bhava Ram, which is a Sanskrit name, which means a pure state of being in the heart. Not that I am pure, but it's something to always seek, to have a pure state of being, to living from that deeper wisdom that we have in our heart, rather than the often frantic noise that's in our minds. And after emerging out of my cave, one of the first things that I wanted to do was make a pilgrimage, and that pilgrimage was to meet the person whose voice I had first heard in that biofeedback room during the darkest night of my soul. That happened to be you. I found that you were at Esalen, and I came and shared my story with you. And to my delight and surprise, you were so open and embracing and acknowledging, and we've been great friends ever since.
Oh, what an incredible story. And what's the... Have you, what's happened with the doctors around your cancer? Because I know sometimes we're kind of
I stopped seeing the doctors for a long time.
Ah.
I've pretty much left Western medicine, although if I was hit by a truck, I would certainly want to be in the hands of Western doctors.
Yeah.
I did go back to see him once years after, just because I had liked him.
Uh-huh.
And no one recognized me because there was 80 pounds less of me and no longer the black circles under my eyes and no longer the big Kevlar clamshell body brace. And they had actually taken my file and put it in the deceased file, figuring that, you know, I had expired long ago. And he was pleased and astonished, and his only comment after I shared my story with him was, well, whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
Nah, okay.
And I've never gone back.
Good doctor.
Good doctor.
Wow, that's incredible. So when you, certainly looking back at your life, there's you've been a peak performer in a number of different ways. You know, in a sense, even your anger and your resentment and turning against the world that you found in the 60s was something in you didn't want to give up, and you were somehow focused on something other than doing what everyone tells you to do. So even that's a kind of peak performance, because you're really being yourself. And peak performance for any, you know, for any person has to do with, you know, somehow being able to listen to that voice inside. It's something that's something that tells you that you're meant for something else. But then, you know, right along the line, as you become involved in trying to right some of the wrongs that you see in the world, from the inside perspective, what was it that drove you on to achieve the things that you achieved, to accomplish the things that you accomplished?
Well, I think one of the important things is having what we might call a power symbol. For me, in the beginning, the power symbol was having grown up with social injustice and really needing at the soul level to find a way to address that and to make a difference, not let it destroy me. And that's, I think, how the journalist arose, where I finally found an avenue to channel that concern and that rage and my own sense of morality and philosophy into something that had an impact and made a difference. So I was driven by something greater than me. I never got into that thinking, I want to be famous, or I want to be wealthy, or I want to be known. I got into it thinking, I need to make a difference. It was something in my core that I was responding to, even though I might not have recognized that at the time. And after crashing and, you know, breaking my back and going into the dark night of the soul, I had really lost all of that. I had lost my entire identity and really turned into, you know, a different person as I fell into the abyss. And the power symbol became that little boy, and those words, get up, daddy. And again, I would offer that it was not trying to survive myself so much as to give him the gift of a father that had some sort of dignity and integrity. And that became my power symbol subsequently, since I experienced this profound healing, and I think this happens to many of us who go through a life change like this, the soul calls us again to now share the message. And I think that's been my power symbol ever since. Shortly after meeting you in Esalen, my new wife and I founded something we called Deep Yoga, which I played on the title of your book, Deep Healing. And we seek to go deep into the ancient teachings of yoga for body, mind, and spirit. And we train students in Vedic therapy and Ayurvedic medicine. We're both now graduates of Ayurvedic medical academies, and some might be called doctors elsewhere, but not in America because of the AMA. And we teach in India, and I've written a few books on yoga and Ayurveda now. But it's that idea of having, you know, I had three missions. My first mission was to make a difference in the world. My second one was to show my son that he had a father that had something to offer him. And the third was to share this miracle of self-healing that we all have within us. To share that and to spread that word, because we all do have an incredible power. While many might think my story was remarkable, what I'd like to say is that if someone so miserable, so pickled on drugs and alcohol, so depressed and disenfranchised and broken and down can do it, you can too. That we all have this power. And I believe it's been stolen from us for the most part. Mm-hmm. We have been made second-class human beings and disenfranchised by a system that doesn't usually have our best interest in mind. And when we take back that power through really being in the present moment, through really shifting our thoughts and our actions and our diet and taking charge of our lives, that power comes out. And that's the power of peak performance. That's the power where we can climb tall mountains, cross wide deserts, swim great oceans. We can make changes in our life because just as I saw these Afghans do incredible things, overcome incredible odds, just as I've seen people as a foreign correspondent, whenever there was crisis, find something inside of themselves that helped them rise up and overcome the most daunting of odds. This is the human condition. We have this within us. This is what gives us the capacity for peak performance. And we can all find it if we dedicate ourselves to what it takes to going to that place.
So it's having that power symbol and really knowing that there's something greater than oneself. You know, a person wrapped up in themselves makes a very small package. But when you realize there's something greater than self, and whether it's righting a social wrong or whether it's being the father that you want to be to your child, or whether it's bringing healing to people, you become aware there's something greater than self, and there's a power that comes to you through that. And when you simultaneously can open up at the level of the heart, then you have an incredible combination. And
that's so beautifully put, and you're so right, Dr. Miller. I think it also involves, when we take charge of our lives, we have to be willing to give up our small self, to give up our bad habits, to devote ourselves again and again every day to a daily practice of achieving that which we have set out to achieve. I say we've been disenfranchised because we've been taught not to make an effort. You know, eat pepperoni pizza all day and drink beer, you have acid indigestion, you get a purple pill. The effort is to change your diet. Mm-hmm. We don't want to do that. We want an external fix. So this idea of owning your power so you can live your truth requires making a commitment to yourself, having faith and courage in yourself as you do seek to honor a larger sense of spirit and oneness in humankind and not be so individually oriented, but to have this daily practice of devotion and dedication to changing your life.
That's
it's a process of stepping up. And usually we're so socialized to be lazy and indulgent that we don't want to do that. So it takes a great crisis. You know, it takes a broken back, cancer, something really daunting, an earthquake in our village, you know, a life tragedy, to make us make these efforts to make change. And I think one of the messages is, don't wait till you're there.
Uh-huh.
We all feel a sense of anxiety and suffering and discomfort living in this stressful, very fast-paced world in which we live. We all feel a dissociation from the soul. It's why we come to yoga. It's why we come to any type of healing practice in our lives. So don't wait till you get there. Find your power now. Find what your truth is and take the time and begin that journey when it's easier and you don't have to climb out from the bottom of an abyss.
Great. Well, in our last minute or so, tell us about where your center is, how people can learn more about you and your work.
Well, thanks for asking. I mentioned we call ourselves Deep Yoga, and our website is deepyoga.com. And we're based in San Diego. My wife and I also teach in India. We do a host of workshops and retreats and what we call mastery of life trainings, and sometimes appear elsewhere in the United States. So anyone that goes to our website can sign up for our newsletter, which we send out very mindfully and not too many, and can learn all about all the various offerings that we have, or can just touch base with us and be in touch. We have free blogs that we put out about nutrition and spiritual transformation and a host of other things that we just like to share with people free of charge.
Okay, I recommend it wholeheartedly. And the titles of your book? The books that...
Pardon me?
The titles of your books that you've already published?
Oh, the two books that I've written are called Deep Yoga, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Times. It's essays on yoga and Ayurveda. And the second book is called The Eight Limbs of Yoga, A Pathway to Liberation. And it takes the centerpiece of the Yoga Sutras, one of the great ancient seminal texts of yoga. It takes its centerpiece, these eight limbs, and articulates throughout the book how we can apply these to our lives at the very deepest philosophical, moral, and spiritual level.
Brad Willis, Bhavaram, thank you so much for being with us, and I wish you all the best with your book next spring, Warrior Pose, and we'll talk before then, but for sure I want to have you back on the show after the book is out there, and I think it's going to be
great.
Thank
you so much, Dr. Miller. Thank you for all you did to help me and the thousands of other people. You have helped us all be strong and healthy and calm and relaxed, and it's a joy to talk with you.
Okay, have a great day. And here to round out the hour is a bit of Healing Journey, the program that Brad heard at the clinic.
Bring into focus all the sights and sounds and tastes and colors and feelings and touch and movement. Every sense awake. Every movement of your body graceful and flowing. Every breath of air reminding you that the universe continues to support you. No need to listen to my voice. Nothing to do but let yourself go where the music takes you, and perhaps experience the gentle fragrance of the air like the perfume of tropical flowers or fruit. As though you can feel the air, palpable, or even see it like a glowing mist that flows into your body with each breath, flows into your chest and your abdomen with each breath. Nothing to do. Just enjoy the place the music takes you, letting my voice become part of the background as the air, almost luminous with a light of life, gently illuminates the rising and falling in the center of you. Perhaps a glowing life green in your upper abdomen as it rises and falls with each breath, or a living yellow, or another color or feeling in your chest. Brighter with each breath in, like rainbow embers, glowing brighter, fed by each breath as the air breathes for you, intensifying the color sensation in your chest as oxygen, prana, chi, the energy of life swirls through your chest, filling the reservoir of your chest with a sound and color and music and feeling that enters so softly, so gently that you can continue to enjoy the place the music is taking you. No need to think or do or even know why. With each breathing out, the healing glow from the center of your chest flows out into each part of your body in little rivulets, little streams that know the pathways to carry the life force, the healing energy, a luminous flow of color and rhythm and melody and harmony from your chest and abdomen, flowing out into your shoulders and your arms, your neck, your head, your pelvis, and your legs, out to the very tips of your toes, flowing out into every cell, gradually and slowly seeing or sensing an image of yourself, experiencing yourself as fully functioning, as healthy and as well as you can imagine letting yourself be. And as you relax and doing nothing, imagine yourself well or see and experience this healthy self. You need not try to feel the glow as each breath flows out from your chest, suffusing and saturating every part, every tissue of your body, as this image slowly begins to form. And perhaps the image that reaches you is like the image of yourself in the past, when everything was well, feeling good and healthy, functioning fully and in balance. Or perhaps you're picturing yourself more healthy than you've ever been, for you can do that too. Just see it, maybe looking and feeling robust like some person you've seen that you would like to be like. Let your own creativity form your image goal. How do you look now, having finished your transformation? How does your body move? How does it feel? Sense it clearly. Sense the movement. Enjoy it. Good. And now let this image ideal fade away for a few moments. And visualize the illness or disease or pattern within yourself that you wish to change. Still relax. Still so calm. Imagine you can look inside and let the image form. It may be visual or a sound or a movement. Let it come to you. And see it now as your inner mind allows you to experience it any way you see it at this moment. Good. Realizing that the image may change from day to day and may be completely unlike any other image anyone else has ever had, but it's yours, and it's like a lens through which your healing energy can now be focused. How do you see it, this unwanted pattern that is temporarily in your body? Maybe you hear it as a discordancy of sound or feel it as a pulsation. Or maybe you can make out a smell, a touch, a movement, or perhaps there are other senses you can use. Let your body do it. How do you sense it? And now recognize that this disease entity, this pattern you wish to eliminate, is not part of you. It's just something superimposed over your healthy self, which still lives and thrives underneath, waiting to be set free. This process is just a smudge which can be washed away. What imagery can you imagine might help facilitate the healing, its removal? Whatever tool you can imagine will overcome this pattern, see it or feel it or sense it in any way that you can. Let your imagination, your creativity do it. You can only be right. Good. We'll call this your healer, your internal healer. Perhaps you imagine white corpuscles engulfing foreign material, or antibodies, or a little army of doctors and nurses, or a religious figure, anything, whatever you can imagine might help eliminate that unwanted image. Good. See your healer, or feel it, or sense it in any way that you can, and imagine it at work, removing the unwanted pattern, the unwanted image, the block to your life force. And as you see it, your body is bringing about a physical healing in the area that needs it. Let your body do it. With each breath, without your needing to know it, your body is sending more and more healing energy to this area. As you watch this image, your healing is being facilitated, speeding up. Like movies of a flower blossoming from a bud to a full bloom, see your healing tools finish their job and see the healthy image of this part of your body. Bring it in more and more clearly. The healthy image that you are underneath, you have healed. You are one with your image ideal. Time has disappeared, and the job is completed. Visualize your healthy image and feel you are one with it. All parts of your body functioning well. You're moving with grace and ease and enjoying every cell of your body, feeling charged with life. And now, as the music carries you like a river, let it take you to an interesting place where you can enjoy the pleasure and comfort of your body and feeling strong, vigorous and free, moving joyfully, looking and feeling the way you really want to, all the parts of you moving in balance and harmony. And the music lets you experience each movement, each smell, each moment, each sight, each sound, each touch, each sensation so vividly. And feel your energy grow with the music. And as the music softens, imagine yourself finding a comfortable place to sit or lie down and rest, wherever you may be. And feel the stillness of your body, your beautiful body, and let relaxation envelop you. Let relaxation envelop you.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, his upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. If you would like to take advantage of Dr. Miller's 20% discount on all of his MP3 guided imagery programs, visit shopdrmiller.com, locate your desired program, and use the promo code DREAM, all lowercase, when checking out. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.